This is the Dr. Denise Show. I'm Dr. Denise McDermott, an adult and child psychiatrist specializing in an integrative approach to mental health. I believe in prescribing the least amount of medication coupled with a comprehensive treatment plan. My goal is to empower you to thrive, and I take a multidimensional approach to wellness, not illness. You are not your symptoms. Call upon your best and highest self to embrace your mental health. On this program, you will meet many doctors, experts, and pioneers who have helped pave the way to shift the paradigm of getting rid of the stigma of mental illness in our society. This show was created for those of you who would like new ways of thinking and understanding about mental health and helping your loved ones to thrive and cope in empowered ways. Today I'm interviewing Dr. Stephen Hannant, aka Dr. Steve, a doctor of psychology and licensed psychologist who specializes in psychological testing, evaluations, consulting, and working with the special needs population of all ages. He also works with professional athletes on mental preparation and training. As an expert in sports psychology, Dr. Steve has developed the Mental Training Program, where he helps people learn how to use the power of the mind to successfully improve their lives and achieve peak performance. He owns and operates Psychological Mobile Services with two offices in North Carolina. Please help me welcome Dr. Steve. Good morning, Dr. Steve. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, thank you for having me. I look forward to it, so it sounds good.
Well, and for everyone listening, I feel like this is another one of those social media wins. It's amazing that we can connect on Twitter and then have a phone call and that we're having this discussion right now.
Yeah, it's things like this that keep me on social media. I'm not a big fan of social media. About every day I contemplate like just deleting all my accounts, and then I meet somebody like, this is why it's worth it. So as of late, this is what's kept me on. And, it seems about every month or so I meet somebody awesome and it's like, okay, it's worth it to deal with all the other social media drama.
Well, it's really interesting because I know you and I both work with kids, and I'm sure we both hear a lot of some of the negative things with social media, with cyberbullying and, ways people put out energy or words kind of into the ethers, and they're not coming from like maybe necessarily the kindest resonance. And so I've been really excited. I've met some of the most fascinating, cool people on Twitter. And so I almost feel like that's its own other topic, that you really can use social media and networking to really make a difference in the world.
For sure. And getting kind of used to the language, I guess. It's kind of like email. When you first get into email years ago, it's kind of short, it's kind of abrupt, and you can't take it too personal. And Twitter's even more so, it's so short-winded, 140 characters.
Yeah. Well, that's why we get to hear more about your work. So we took our relationship quickly off the 140 characters. And we picked up the phone and got to know each other. Yeah. And so I feel fortunate that we got to talk before this. And I would love for you, I know you have a program called Mental Training. What exactly is mental training?
So good question. So the mental training program is about conditioning the mind for success. I took a major last minute dissertation change when I was working on my PhD or PsyD, pretty much the same thing. And people just don't know as much about that. But towards that doctoral degree, I was in drug and alcohol addictions and harm reduction, and it had just gotten really complicated, and it was almost going to take longer to finish that than switch to sports psychology, which I had a real interest in and more of a passion in. And really, it was just more fun. So I took a major changeover, started studying elite athletes and the type of mindsets that kind of set them apart from other professionals or top level amateurs. And a lot of the research at that time was in, Olympic type athletes. And so I had an opportunity to work with some professional and high level professionals, what, you kind of identify as the elite, the top of the food chain. And that's what created.
Can you tell us what year that was and some of the athletes that you initially were working with when you were doing your dissertation? Because there's so much in the history of sports and how far we've come. So it'd be interesting to hear what year that was and then who you met as you're telling us about your mental training program.
Sure. And let's see now. Time flies. So I end up wrapping up around 2007. So the project probably started in 2005. One of the, you know, and I got into mixed martial arts because I was a big fan of the Ultimate Fighting Championships. And at that time, it was pretty big. I mean, there was a lot of big athletes and well-known names. It just wasn't as quite as mainstream now. I think at that time it was still, you know, banned in a few states and considered kind of barbaric, and the rules were not as quite as tight as they were now. So there was some pretty grimacing fights and, you know, the stuff that kind of kept it off the mainstream TV. I think then it was still all pay-per-view. Now, you know, you can watch it on regular TV.
The irony of this is that the very first person that I interviewed for my show was Gary Goodrich.
Yeah, so I mean, he's one of the early, you know, pioneers. And even when the rules were even, what would you say, more loose, you know, and so, you know, those guys.
He would fight three fights in one night.
Right. I mean, and with very little rules. I mean, that's when you allowed the, like, headbutting and kicking on the ground. I mean, these guys, he's one of the original warriors, so to speak. Well, not so to speak, but really, literally, you know, in that mindset, you know, not as a military warrior, but in the idea of sport. And so these guys kind of founded it, you know, and did it for very little money. And overseas, they'd make more. But, you know, I had a real interest in it, and just for as an entertainment value. But I boxed, and so I enjoyed all sorts of fighting and always interested in wrestling. But the mixed martial arts, and what I found was, you know, looking at all sports, but especially mixed martial arts, the origin is in martial arts, which has these strong ties to Eastern, you know, philosophy and disciplines. And when I was working on my doctoral dissertation, my mentor, two of them, one was a sports psychologist for the San Diego Chargers and the San Diego Padres, as well as a successful clinician that also in the drug and alcohol field. So he was the perfect one that ran my dissertation, and I switched from drug and alcohol to sport. He was a master in both. My other mentor
what's his name?
Dr. Stephen Buckey.
Perfect.
And he's just awesome, and just guided me through the transition and was able to kind of set me up in really whatever direction I wanted to go, whether it was with football players or all this, but I just had this passion for MMA. And then my other mentor, I was a part of the Integrative Studies program ran by Dr. Eulert, and Don Eulert, a Native American, full blood, and just lived on a farm, totally self-sufficient, built everything on his farm, had a Native American sweat on the farm. We'd go there and have get-togethers and gatherings and sweat and then talk and, you know, feast. And it was just, you know, really the best of both worlds versus one guy living in, you know, the upper end of San Diego, driving a Mercedes, and the other one living on a farm who built his own house, you know, and drove into the campus with an old truck. And so
I am smiling. I know that this is an audio interview, but that is so cool. Like, I can't even tell you how much fun it was to be you, and still is, but awesome.
You know, I'm smiling too, because I look back, I don't get to talk about this stuff a lot. And, you know, it was just this blessing. Like, you know, it's like God just like gave you these two people that, you know, you wound up there and got to be a part of their life. And meanwhile, I'm living on the beach in Pacific Beach in San Diego and going to surf almost every day. And so, you know, life wasn't tough at all. Besides, you know, what it took to, you know, get through the doctoral program. And then I was working overnight shifts at a crisis center near Tijuana to, you know, make some money.
I I feel like we were having this interview because we're kindred spirits. When I was at UCLA doing my child psychiatry training, I was working, I was moonlighting in maximum security prisons. I was up in Corcoran. I was in the SHU. I had to wear those vests that they have. At the time, California was having those rolling power outages where I was like, oh my gosh, what does that mean? Well, if that happens, will they still be locked in? So it sounds like we have some interesting kind of off the podcast stories to discuss.
Yeah, I don't.
But it sounds like we're both kindred. Like, wait, what did you say?
I said your job didn't sound like moonlighting.
Well, you know, I have to say though, and as you're about to tell us about mental training, it sounds like you're absolute in alignment with your passion of what you wanted to do in this lifetime.
It just worked out, and you know, and so combining, you know, the sport and then a lot of the Native American, and then I had other professors that one was a Catholic and a Buddhist. He'd kind of combined his religions, Dr. Spira from the same college, and he introduced me to a lot of Eastern practices. So here I got, you know, mainstream Western technology and sports psych that's being used by sports psychologists for professional athletes, you know, that Dr. Bucky's using. Dr. Hewlett, the Native American practices that have been used for, you know, thousands of years before, you know, a lot of people even got, you know, anyone got to this country. And then the Eastern practices, they're, you know, as old as can be. And then the thing that made it all come together was in martial arts, you know, whether it be karate or taekwondo or kung fu or even wrestling, when you look back at the, you know, the origin of it, you know, all has this base that's tied into these same practices, you know, that go back to arousal regulation, breathing exercises, visualization, you know, even like the fundamentals of health exercises like qigong that kind of led to tai chi and kung fu. But so a lot of the martial artists were exposed to this stuff, whether they picked it up later on or as kids, you know, in karate class or whatever they took, you know, and so the discipline was there. And so it was a lot easier to, when we get into mental training, to study this group because they seem to have the best understanding of it. I was fortunate enough to, one of the original winners and legends, I think he had over 4,000 fights in wrestling. And then I think he's on the verge. He's still competing here and there. Dan Severn, the Beast, you know, is going to have close
wow.
to 100 fights. He was the first and one of only four at that time. Now there's more, but UFC Hall of Famers. Matt Lindlin, he not only was an Olympic medalist, but just an unbelievable leader in the community. He was in politics early on, and you know he's just one of the greatest persons. And he ran Team Quest, which has produced a ton of champions. And so I got. They responded to kind of my email solicitations, and Dennis Kane was a champion at that time from Canada. And so I got some folks from different places. Brad Imes was one that he had won that. It was the first show, you know, that came out, the Ultimate Fighter on TV. I think he was on like season three and he had won it. And so I had somebody that was known on TV when it got into the reality shows. Travis Luter was one of the champions again from the TV shows. And so I got some more mainstream folks. Jeff Monson was an early well-known champion that fought all over the world. And he was really culturally diverse. He's kind of radical, extreme politic wise. And so he had this very different view on martial arts and history. And, you know, so I ended up having about 8 guys and then I had some younger fighters and, you know, part of my sample was some diversity as far as folks that had either lived or trained all over the world, guys that were younger, that were just getting started, that were considered the best at that time, like Pete Sell and Drew Fickett. And then some of the legends that I discussed earlier. And so I had a pretty good sample and it was,
So did you interview, so can you just give us a quick synopsis of, so what you interviewed them, studied them, looked at their mental health, like, can you give us an idea of what you did with all your meetings with these elite athletes?
Yeah, during the study, it was everything was pretty much done by phone. You know, later on, people I connected with, I actually went out to their training camps and got to meet them, you know, the kind of the follow-up was really cool where it all led to. But early on, it was just studying these elite athletes and interviewing them and just having a qualitative study that included a lot of questions and really digging deep into these core aspects of focus and discipline and how it affects peak performance and therefore success. And so the main things that we, and then what it led to is kind of the core components. And that is goal setting.
Okay.
Breath work, imagery and visualization, and kind of the subtleties between the both of them, attention and concentration, self-hypnosis, also known as like autogenic training, arousal regulation, the use of rituals and routine, and then the practice of meditation, and if they include mindfulness as a part of that, just depending on how they describe it. But the and what we found is, and what was kind of known going in, and you know, the hypothesis, whatever, trying to expect to find. I speak in pretty much layman's all the time, but
but that's awesome. That's what we need. That's perfect.
But when you look at these top athletes, and the idea is that when you get to the cream of the crop, you know, the diet, the physical conditioning, the practice or sport training for their specific sport, you know, they're all great. I mean, they're all using the highest level as can be. Back then, it wasn't quite as evolved in martial arts as it is now with these diet, condition, and sport training. But, you know, now it's even higher level. You know, when you get into NFL, I mean, it's down to a science, you know. But the mental training is in the mental strength, really, whether they train or not, or just had it naturally, is really what separated the best from the rest. And that's what I was so interested in.
I love that. I love that because the mind, it's amazing what your own mind can do to take you to the absolute next level in sports, in business, in medicine, in spiritual practice. So this is awesome.
And that was just it. You know, and it was interesting even to study, you know, having some of the younger guys versus the older guys, and of course the older ones I got were ones that had survived a very, you know, tough sport to survive in, especially when the money wasn't all there, unless you were like number one and had to stay number one. And so the guys that survived in that sport were just, you know, one, unbelievably talented; two, they had a great passion for it and a love for it, and just super driven. So the idea. And then if you look back at the study now, if I did like a reflection, the ones that are still in it or a part of it, you know, really at the elite level, what separates them was almost just obvious when you talk to them, just the way they described their kind of mental game, in a sense, the what goes into their goal setting, whether or not, you know, they were using breath work, you know, as an application or just naturally kind of did it and were good at it, whether they kind of were trained in imagery and visualization or they were just naturally good at it, the type of attention and concentration, almost OCD like in their life as far as the intensity, what you hear a lot about like in graduate studies and doctors and stuff, just how, you know, the OCD traits, you know, where it's not a disorder.
Yeah, the obsessional style. In fact, that's a very important point. I think the linear language, you know, as a doctor and you as a psychologist, I think we both realize that behavior is on a spectrum and that all of our strengths can be our weaknesses. And if you have an obsessive style or if you have ADD and you can hyper-focus on things you love, once you know your neuro style, you can just use that to your advantage. You know, all of our behavior traits can be used for the good and for really accomplishing our goals.
I love that you said neuro style. That's such a beautiful way to kind of put a positive spin on what now is like, you know, neuro disorders, you know, neurodevelopmental disorder. Everything's the weakness. But I love the idea that you said neuro style. I'm gonna steal that from you when I.
No, that's cool. Actually, please do. When I talked to Dr. Lydia Zaloska, we were talking about at UCLA about the mindfulness program with ADD. And then Dr. Budding last week, her podcast just came out. She's a neuropsychologist I work with. And I just, my blog this week is called Embrace Your Neurostyle.
Oh, awesome. That's great.
Because the language, I believe that the language that we use affects how we see ourselves.
For sure.
And to me, we all have strengths and weaknesses. And if we know our style, you know, whether someone ever needs to come see you or I for clinical reasons, that's a different issue and that's fine. But people can still thrive if they have things that maybe at one time in their life caused issues, where in kind of the Western medicine need to kind of have an insurance code. And also, by the way, I want to respect science. We have to have a way of talking about things. But if we view ourselves as beings with our own neurostyle, that quickly dissipates the stigma. And so please do. I want to catch on new language so that more people embrace their mental health at an earlier age. So I just think words like neurostyle and, you know, our neurology, that just makes it more real and more accepting and more like we all have behavior. We all have thoughts and feelings.
And that's for sure. And that will kind of lead in, and I'll actually use that term when I kind of shift from how sports psychology, the same tools that we're using in mental training program that I use in my day-to-day practice with children, especially in pediatrics, doing for, you know, neurodevelopmental concerns, you know, with the onset of rapid, you know, epidemic of ADHD, you know, where every kid that comes in, you know, is being referred for that, and, you know, or learning disorders, you know, everything that falls into, and even the high functioning autism stuff that's really, you know, the neuro style of that being, and how a lot of these exercises can be used in a way that can benefit them to help that neurodevelopment. Because if we've seen in a lot of the neuroscience research, and one of my favorites is Dr. Siegel with the whole brain child, how a lot of this stuff is can be shaped in throughout your lifetime, but, you know, especially in your prime years.
Yes. And so that's actually what I was going to say. So you just, in your dissertation, what really separated the elite athletes from the other athletes was the power of their mind, their natural use of these mental tools that you're going to describe for our listeners. And so do you want to go through, you listed a bunch of the tools. Would you like to just share what some of those tools are? And then we can talk about how you integrate that in your day-to-day work as well as with athletes.
Sure. So the core ones that are identified, the most widely used and trainable. You know, some people obviously have some natural ability already, and then other people you find that are very trainable. And then, of course, the combination of both works even better. But what these do, and what I've talked about even in some of my blogs, none recently, but early on, and I do some now for some golf magazines, but mental training often gets grouped as mental toughness. And they're not even, you know, close. I mean, they're in the same genre, you know, they're mental, but you can be mentally tough. You can be that guy, you know, that just, you get knocked down, a guy or girl, and you get up and, you know, you get fired from a job, you come back and get a better job. And you're just one of these people that you're just tough, and mentally people just can't break it, you know, but that is different. You can be mentally tough, but still have a short attention span, have poor breathing, you know, habits, be poor at visualization. You can't de-escalate well. You may have anger management problems. You may be disorganized and aren't good in your rituals and routine. You may be non-mindful. You eat fast. You don't pay attention. You have weight problems. You know, there could be a poor goal setter, but you can be tough as nails, right? And so what I try to help people understand, mental toughness is awesome. And it's a huge attribute, but it's not exactly what I'm talking about.
No, I understand. So mental toughness is more like your natural reflex to how your natural resiliency factor, your kind of baseline resiliency.
That, and it can be enhanced too. It's just not exactly what I'm talking about at this moment. I mean, I deal with that too, mental toughness. You know, I get some kids in all the time that just mentally, you know, not tough, you know, and weak for a nice way to say it. But, you know, it's like, hey, listen, you got to get this kid on the track team. You got to get out there and play some, get to karate, and you got to have somebody be tough on this kid. You know, he's not getting it home. He's not getting it somewhere. There's some mentally weak attributes that can be toughened up through discipline, right? Some people are like, you know what? I was kind of soft and I joined the military and now I'm hard. You know, I'm disciplined, I'm focused. And, you know, so a lot of it can be altered in your environment, you know, nature, nurture, of course. And some people are just born with it, but some people have to find it. I mean, I think it's all shapeable to a certain degree, some people more than others. Mental training, we're talking about tools or skills and drills. And so one of my, you know, philosophies is that you know skills and you do drills. And so there's study factors that you have to learn about it. That's knowing, right? Knowing is half the battle. And then do the drills, because your brain, just like a muscle, you know, works on repetition. You know, it's like nobody, oh, I want to lose weight. Okay, go to the gym. You worked out today and then you went for a run. Awesome. Okay, are you done? You know, one day? No, I don't think it's going to work like that, right? Meditation is the same way, just to pick one topic. You know, it's got to be done over and over, repetition, right? You know, you're not going to lose weight. Your biceps not going to grow in inches over one workout. And your brain works the same way. So we talk about goal setting. You know, setting one goal. Oh, yeah, I'm a goal setter. I set a goal for my life. Okay, one goal. Okay, that's a good start. But, you know, so we break down goal setting. We break down breath work. You know, there's so many different types of goal setting and different levels of really being a master goal setter. Breath work, imagery and visualization. You know, where's your imagery level? Like, are you someone that can imagine stuff like, you know, black and white in your brain and, you know, it's kind of like 2D, or are you like a 3D high def movie visualization person? Attention and concentration. You know, what's your level, you know, of focus and the ability to block out distractions and stay tuned in, self-hypnosis, not autogenic training, really, you know, your ability, and that goes kind of with arousal regulation, the ability to kind of de-escalate, be able to include some self-talk, which would be more along the self-hypnosis, and arousal regulation, the ability to kind of lower the heart rate. And so you got kind of two different areas there that include a lot of different techniques, everything from progressive muscle relaxation to guided imagery, you know, to the self-hypnosis kind of new age type things, as well as neurofeedback and some other more modern tech stuff. Rituals and routine, you know, how, and I joke with people, one of my first questions is when we're talking about the rituals and routine is like, how OCD are you? Are you someone that's like got to put the left shoe on first and tie it a certain way? Or are you more flexible? And then wherever you stand on that continuum, what's your resiliency when things don't go your way, when you don't get that to eat at that special place before because you ran out of time, or you didn't get to put on your favorite game day shirt because it didn't get washed, you know, or something. You know,
I love that. You're talking about flexibility, adaptability.
Right. And that goes into that OCD traits are good, OCD disorder is bad. You know, like when it doesn't have a positive outcome, then it's not working for you. And so the rituals and routine are so key for that, and your flexibility of meditation and mindfulness, and, you know, so many different types of meditation and mindfulness, how it applies to so many different parts of your life. Are you a mindful athlete? But okay, that's awesome, and that helps your sport, but do you apply it to your eating habits, or your, you know, if you're dealing with weight, or do you apply it to your parenting skills? Do you apply it in your relationships, you know, with people or your partner, and how that affects you? Because there's people that are great on the court or on the field, but they're jerks at home, you know? So it's like, okay, you're mindful, what, only on the basketball court, or, you know, so you're only when you're fighting. And so, you know, all these things go into not just training a person as an athlete, but as a character and as a person in our, you know, society. Is the ultimate.
I love that. I think that's important. And I think it's important for our children. That's been a big theme throughout many of my discussions. Imagine children having this integrated into the school system.
And yeah, and we did a program after this, not to, years, one of my daughters was in kindergarten, and my wife, you know, struggling with the whole send them to school, and I'm going to miss them. She's like, oh, well, you know what, let's use your program to start like a class so I can go to school and hang out with my kid. You know, so it worked out perfect. And so
I love that. She sounds like a creative out of the box thinker. Way to go.
Awesome. So we created this program that was called the Super Kids, and it was an hour long program that used all these techniques here, and basically these core eight ones that I mentioned for kids that could be broken down at a level for like kindergartners. And we use the John Wooden, you've mentioned UCLA before and being tied to them, the pyramid to success, which is awesome. And I live by it. And then the kids version, and then we'd simplify it even more for, you know, kindergartners, obviously, but exposed them to, you know, goals, breathing exercises, visualization. Kids are awesome. Their imagination is so awesome. It's so, you know, skewed by a society in a sense. And so their imagination is awesome. Their attention is obviously something that, some better than others, that we have to, that we work on, you know, it's part of the neurodevelopment exercises, the self-talk that falls into self-hypnosis, the arousal regulation, to be able to kind of regulate your heart rate and even know what that means, you know, at an early age. The rituals and routine, which were done by the group, was the same group every time we did it, every time. It was like clockwork. So that was kind of like the, you know, the, like in the military and in certain sports, kind of the routine and rituals that kind of set stuff up, the cadence of the program. And then exposing them to different types of meditation, mindfulness and Zen, and just, you know, breathing meditations, and, you know, at an early, and kid, I'll tell you what, kids loved it. They didn't want that class ever to end, and it was awesome. And we've used it since then in group therapies, and then I use it.
You use that in your practice with your psych mobile service, and then are you still continuing to do that at the schools?
Not at this time at the schools. It got a little bit more complex. Now she's grown up. She's in fifth grade. Then we got a first grader, kindergartner, and some of the administration staff had changed, and it just didn't. We didn't keep it up, and my wife got doing other stuff. Our business grew here. We have multiple clinics now, and she took over. So we had some business structural changes that didn't allow us to do it at the school. And I don't actually do groups myself anymore. I used to do a lot of these in groups, but now I have people working for me that run the groups. And so they incorporate it into the groups. I incorporate it. I pretty much do psychological evaluations almost every day, all day long, and then follow-up consults.
You know what, Steve, what you're about to talk about is incredible. I was just thinking, I wanted to talk about how you do integrate that in your day-to-day practice of psychology, as well as more about your mental training program. Okay. Normally we take a break and I have sometimes a commercial, sometimes not, but I'm sort of following my intuition here. And, we spoke earlier, you and I, about you connecting with Gary Goodrich.
Oh, yes.
And I just thought of this while I was on. He's become my really, like, I actually will say he's one of my dear friends since I interviewed him. I probably talked to him two or three times a week. And I just texted him, and I thought we could just call him and put him on speaker, and you guys could say hello for a little bit. Then we could finish the interview. Does that sound like fun?
Oh, that sounds really cool. Yeah, I get to speak.
Okay. Let's get Big Daddy. Let's get Big Daddy on the phone.
Yeah.
Okay, everyone? Okay, here we go. It's going to be on my speakerphone iPhone.
Okay, cool.
Let me turn this up too.
Hello, Denise.
Gary, hi, how are you?
I'm almost wonderful. How are you?
Good. So, Big Daddy, I just did a spontaneous move, and I'm on the phone with Dr. Steve, who's a sports psychologist who did his dissertation on elite MMA fighters. So I thought, who best to call? I thought, we don't want to hear about Dr. Denise, the commercial. We want to hear about Big Daddy Gary Goodrich. Can you say hi to Dr. Steve? Here's Gary.
Okay. How's everything?
Good. Going good. It's a pleasure.
Hello?
Yes, sir. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Hold on a second.
All right.
I'm going to figure this out. Okay. Hold on one second. For all of you out there listening, please excuse my new. I'm adapting to technology. Okay, so Gary, this is Dr. Steve. Go ahead, Steve.
Hey, hello, Dr. Steve.
How you doing? Can you hear me?
Hello.
Can you hear him? He's saying hello. Can you hear Gary?
I can hear him, you know, like I can.
Okay,
hear
so you know what I'm going to do? Because Gary can't hear you, but that's okay. So, Gary, can you just give the audience a shout out and tell us a little bit about just, you know, Dr. Steve was just talking about the pioneers in MMA. And can you just tell us a little bit about what it was like at the beginning with the fights, like how many you would do and maybe some of your.
You know, the beginning was amazing, incredible. I loved it. It was, you know, in order to win a fight, you had to win three fights in one night. And these, nowadays, you can win something with having one fight a year or you know, we have to do three fights in one night. If you wanted to win the tournament, or you wanted to walk away the champion, you have to win three fights in one night. I had three fights the first night I started. I fought Don Fry again, and I lost the belt, the UFC number 8 belt, because I wasn't able to stay with him. Anyways, I went from there to IBC. I don't know if you people know that, but IBC was the International Bali Judo Championship. That was pretty much no rule. And we fought three fights in one night. I ended up winning that the IBC belt that very night, 97. I won the belt in IBC. And in Brazil, Sergio Bastalelli tournament, we had a great time. I ended up, as I said, I won. And then from there, my career went on to Pride and then K1. But at the beginning time, like I said, you had to win three fights in one night. We didn't know anything about winning one. You know, you're champion if you win one. But we didn't know anything about that. We're in the old school. You have to beat up many people.
So, Gary, Dr. Steve was just talking about when he interviewed so many people for his dissertation, the difference between the elite athletes who won, a big portion of it was the mental state, your mental game, and how to win, and how to think, and how to visualize, and use your breathing. And so can you tell us some of your tips that you use when you were in sort of your elite nights, where you were in the champion zone, what kind of mind space you were in?
You know, the mindset, you gotta have, you gotta take all the doubts. Well, for myself, but I guess everybody's a little different. But for myself, I had to take every doubt in my head away. I had to look after all the bad the naysayers, because I had a ton of naysayers, when I started, because everybody, oh no, you can't win them. These people are gonna beat you because they've been doing it for life. You haven't done anything. You had to get rid of all the naysayers. You had to get into a zone where nothing can hit you, nothing can penetrate you. If you had a naysayer in your camp, you had to get rid of that person. You didn't want that person around in your camp because you had to go. You didn't want anyone that didn't believe you or didn't believe that you were the best in your camp. So, therefore, your camp you had to trim up all the fat off of the steak. Just came with them bare meat. Just everything that you wanted, you had to go hard. And people that believed you and that knew that you could do it, those are the people that were around and you went from there.
That's awesome. So, Dr. Steve, you can't hear Dr. Steve. Dr. Steve, is there anything you want to say and I can say it to Gary so we can get your input?
Well, I think if I would have had his email back then in those days, he would have been in my study and I could tell you, he would have lined up great in one of the chapters when it discusses the cognitive sports psychology aspect, when he talked about, you know, dealing with doubts, negative thinking styles. The type of mindset he just described, it lines up perfectly, like what I said, with folks that were successful over time. You know, to have that type of longevity in such a tough career, just... Yeah. You know, had to stay that focus.
So Gary can't hear you, but Gary, so basically Dr. Steve, when he was doing his dissertation, he had a chapter about that kind of absolute mindset of no doubts, clearing it, like I'm going to win, visualization. And so he said, you know, he did his dissertation at 2005, 2006, but you would have been someone, had he had your email, he would have loved to interview. And I've already co-emailed both of you because I know that Gary will, Dr. Steve, help in any way he can on your mental training site. And perhaps in the new year in 2017, I'll have an event where you both get to meet. But Gary, before we say, you know, gosh, by the way, Gary, thank you so much, dude, for just letting me call you like this. Thank you.
My phone lines are always productive.
Thank you. Yeah, Dr. Gary and I, we've been inspiring each other of different ways we could help. So Dr. Steve's helping us and inspire all these people listening. So, so Gary, does it sound good? I'll make sure you and Dr. Steve connect outside of this interview. But Dr. Steve, is there anything else you want to say to Gary before we hang up with him?
Well, let him know that I appreciate, I call it his fight. You know, he's had a ton of fights, but his fight is the best way to describe, you know, probably all his fights in one, just the type of attitude. And, you know, as an entertainer, to sacrifice your body and mind, you know, for the sake of all the people that love watching that sport. And you know, he was one of the pioneers and, you know, is still a living legend. And so I just appreciate him for what he's done for MMA. And, you know, they really created a modern masterpiece sport, and it's because of guys like him.
So Gary, so Dr. Steve just expressed his gratitude for the pioneers in MMA like yourself. And he said, thank you for the fight. And hold on, there's something going on in your car, Gary. He said, thank you for, go ahead.
Nothing's going on. Go ahead.
Okay. He said, thank you for the fight, your fight and your contribution as a pioneer. And I want to thank you for your fight inside the ring and now your fight outside the ring. Dr. Steve, Gary has been going through some depression that's been getting a lot better. So it waxes and wanes, but he actually was in Ohio doing some seminars for children, passing out toys. We're going to have him on in November talking about the spirit of giving and how that can be super healing. So as a male athlete role model at this time in Gary's career, he wants to raise awareness of mental health as well as talk with children, and he's been donating time and handing out toys to children at this time. So Gary, thank you for your fight inside and outside of the ring.
Anytime. I did what I did because I loved it, and I thought it was important to myself at the time. I love what I did, and if I had to do it all over again, of course I would do things a little different, but I would do it all over again.
That's awesome. Okay, Gary. Well, I'm going to finish up my interview with Dr. Steve. I'll call you later to say thank you. Thank you so much for jumping on, and Dr. Steve will be in touch with you. Okay?
Yeah, Dr. Steve, give him my email and my my Twitter now handle, and even and my phone number. You can call me, and we can chat anytime. Love to.
Excellent. Okay, Gary. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, cool. Dr. Steve, thank you so much for being spontaneous like that.
Well, that was great. I got to talk to one of, you know, I'm a fan as well as, you know, a psychologist. And so any opportunity to speak with and connect with, especially the legends, I appreciate it.
Yeah. So you were, before we got on the call with Gary, we were talking about the ways that you integrated the skills that you've learned, the mental training skills. It sounds like you utilize those in your practice every day. You use them with your program with athletes. So can you give us a little bit of an idea? I know because you work with some of the same clinical situations that I do. Can you give us an example of how you integrate that into your work?
Well, there's two routes basically. If I'm dealing with an athlete, depending on where they're at and their kind of mental training game, I went ahead and developed the online program, which you can access at mentaltrainingprogram.com. And I've broken it up to some of the main sports that are using mental training right now, like MMA. There's an NFL program, there's a tennis, and then golf, which is one of my big ones right now, as well as a mental fitness program for mental training. So there's really a pretty common introduction for all those sports. And it's like a 25-day program. Then once you go through that, there's a 58-day program that kind of advances the skills. You go through a lot of the same ones again. A lot of people don't understand that mental training is pretty mundane, you know, doing goals and doing more goals, doing breathing, meditating and more meditating. You know, it's not one of these, you know, I know nowadays they try to make a lot of stuff new age and technology wise and all that, and that's cool. But hardcore discipline mental training's still pretty old school and pretty mundane. It can get pretty boring, but that's really what strengthens that mind. And so we utilize that. And then, of course, as you move up the ladder as far as your mental game, there's more personalized type of training programs, what we call mental training challenges that really kind of take you to the next level. And we're using, I'm using a lot of, incorporating a lot of Wim Hof, who's just kind of the man right now, breaking all sorts of Guinness Book of World Records by self-regulation techniques with breathing, dealing with cold water situations. And he's came out with a new app, which has to do with different types of kind of yoga flexibility exercises, breathing exercises, and cold water therapy treatments. And so I'm using a lot of that too for really my performance enhancement type folks. Then I tone it down in my day-to-day world, specializing with kids and special needs, autism spectrum disorders, intellectual disabilities, so lower level of cognitive type functioning, as well as, you know, of all ages, as well as kids, and especially young kids in pediatrics in the developmental years, because I specialize in evaluation, so I'm doing a lot of testing. And so a lot of my follow-up recommendations, whether it be in the outpatient therapies, behavioral therapies, cognitive behavioral therapies, occupational therapies, speech therapies, you know, all these different things, I try to sum it up in neurodevelopment as far as controlling what you have control of. Working with the parents as far as recommending things related to setting realistic goals for the kids. And so their expectations are more in line with what their capabilities are. Everybody comes in, and you, God bless, you love parents, you know. My kid's so bright, you know, but he doesn't do this, and he's doing this and this. And then, you know, you get through a full battery of IQ testing, and you realize, yeah, he is bright in certain special ways, but there's a lot of weakness areas that kind of contribute to all these problems you're having. So we need to kind of reset our goals as far as what you're expecting from this child, and that will also help you figure out what you need to be working on, and so they can do better. So they're not set up to fail.
What you're talking about, can you explain? This is psychoeducational testing, correct?
Well, I...
Or do you do... Because Dr. Budding just spoke about neuropsychology testing. So it's really confusing for people who don't have the PsyD or the PhD or the MD. All these psychology terms sort of blend to one for society. So can you describe that specific testing that you're doing? Because I do agree that parents have to have a realistic expectation of their child's neuro style. And so right. They get a lot of data from what your report is.
So I'll put it in layman's. When a kid comes in, and depending on their age, once they can read well, then you start to be able to assess the personality a little bit more, because you can do some personality type assessments. But prior to that, you're basically doing some projective testing, kind of looking at their emotional status, you know, let's call it emotional IQ, kind of where they're at emotionally, their communication skills, where they test on expressive and receptive abilities, ability to understand, and then a higher level than understand is comprehend, and the ability to express, you know, to speak, and different levels of that, you know, it gets complex, like pragmatics. And then, of course, the core kind of intellectual functioning. And we're looking at things like their verbal intelligence, you know, simply like vocabulary, and then it gets more complex than that. Problem solving, their ability to do it not only, you know, verbally, but non-verbally, visually. Their working memory. A lot of times, we're looking at short-term, non-verbal, and that's typically visual, and then also auditory, which is verbal. We'll look at processing speed. And so, you know, I'm testing for these things, and then depending on the age and really early on, whether it's pre-academic or academic, looking at their level of reading skills or basic reading skills, and, you know, identifying net letters, numbers, sight words, and then comprehension is more complex. Looking at mathematic abilities from basic, from knowing numbers all the way to solving problems. Written, I don't get a whole lot into written nowadays just because I don't do psychoed stuff. I kind of do more of a full battery. And with computers and all that, I'm less interested into how you can spell and write. And so, but I as a part of the assessment, it's important, especially if we got concerns of dyslexia, and you know, which is only one piece of written, but the idea is we may assess spelling or something like that. But the idea is we look at the core components, and also then behavioral issues, you know, and things like that we'll assess for, you know, and maybe survey teachers and parents and their viewpoint as well. And so we're getting kind of a full spectrum. I really do a lot of more of kind of neuropsych type testing, neuropsychological testing, as well as some psychoed, as well as projective psychological, and combine it. Kind of take the best of the best tests that I've found over the years to simplify, figure out somebody's neuro style of functioning, and then help kind of prescribe this neurodevelopmental workout that kind of stems from Dr. Segal's, you know, the whole brain child, which looks at not only intellectual development, achievement development, like your scholastic skills, and your ability as far as emotional intelligence. So you have those three components. And then that falls into that is your social communication skills. So your social kind of communication intelligence. Later on, you may call it, you know, your kind of personality style, you know, how you deal with yourself and others in our world. Then I take the mental training program, which is great at addressing all those things. Your goal setting, your breathing exercises, your visualization, the attention and concentration drills, the cognitive psychology that includes the things like self-talk and then self-regulation, which has to do with self-control, which is so big in neurodevelopment, rituals and routine, which has to do with discipline and, you know, and what that means for, and then meditation and mindfulness, and try to expose, whether I'm the first to expose or kind of help people enhance their own routine and rituals or program or schedules, activity schedules of what they're already doing to help their kids. And unfortunately, what I find is most young kids and teenagers too going up in special needs, you know, they're not doing any of these things. I mean, you don't get it in school anymore. I mean, they won't let you sweat in PE because they don't want to get sued. you don't get a lot of recreation time on the playground. And then there's so many, you know, the idea of cliques and peers and bullies and all this stuff that goes on, you know, it's really tough for kids to find their emotional intelligence and their, you know, confidence and self-esteem, unless you're kind of at the cream of the crop in the social hierarchy. And then if you're not involved in extracurricular sports because they're so expensive and parents are working two jobs or it's a single family home, you know, you just don't get this stuff. You don't have a great coach or mentor. In single family mother homes, they're missing a male father figure, and then mom's dealing with five other kids, and so we're missing certain types of attention. So the neurodevelopment right now is out of control, you know.
And right. So that's a big part of the population that you see, that they don't have access to this kind of enrichment.
That's a great way to put it. Yeah. I mean, little, if any, and then the classroom's got 30 kids. So you're not getting in the class. You know what I mean? And then you may be on an IEP and get pulled out for some individual time here and there, but it just blows my mind for kids, the lack of these critical skills really that are going on.
So what you're talking about, I'm very, very passionate about, or we wouldn't be on this call and this podcast. And, sounds like we're kindred spirits just on other sides of the country. In the school system here in Manhattan Beach, Goldie Hawn's Mind Up program is integrated into the curriculum.
Cool.
So the kids are learning, they have, which is actually based on work that Dr. Dan Siegel at UCLA, where I also trained. So we have that. We're very fortunate, but this is an enriched environment. So we have, you know, people knowing what sensory breaks are or the need for outdoors. And so your mental training program, the concept of everything that you have done your body of work on is something that I believe we all can benefit from in every environment, whether it's the schools, whether it's at work. And so your program, and you said you created your site too, so that it could be a lot of information for people who maybe don't have access to something like that, that's integrated into their school or work. And so when you meet with these kids after you know their neuro style, you've assessed them. And let's say it's one of the most challenging situations where like there's just one parent and not as much attention because the parent's just really trying to put food on the table. You come up with sort of a tailored version of mental training program that's realistic for that given situation.
And pretty much because I do so many evaluations and I don't get a lot of ongoing consultations and therapy with one client, I pretty much introduce people to kind of a basic program in a sense. And I call it, it's kind of the whole brain workout, kind of stemming from the whole brain child books of Dr. Dan Siegel, incorporating the mental training drills, and focuses on these core areas of development that need to be focused on that they can start doing at home. And what I call it is like an hour workout. It's kind of, I took it from the 60 minutes of play, like the NFL commercials, 60 minutes of play a day. It's like,
that's awesome.
You know, there's play, like running wild and just being a free kid, which is awesome, but that doesn't necessarily help your neurodevelopment. I mean, it probably has some side effect help, but the idea is that some focused play, where you're actually doing stuff with goal, intention, and a purpose that's meaningful, and we break it down to different types of communication, different types of motor skills from fine to gross to visual, different types of imagination drills, self-control drills, and problem-solving drills. And so we focus on those five things, then we incorporate the mental training into that, and basically prescribe to parents an hour that addresses each of those things, which is averages about 10 minutes, which would equal 50 minutes, but if you're a couple minutes transition in between, takes about an hour, or focus on one thing for 60 minutes or two things for 30 minutes each, basically to kind of address these things throughout the week, depending on what they have possible in you know, their schedule. A lot of people are just so busy to do it. I say, okay, well, my motto is 15 minutes a day. You have to commit to one of these things at least 15 minutes a day. 15 minutes a day is 1% of your day. If you can't commit your time or your child's time to 1% of your day to get better, mentally stronger, then I can't help you, basically. No, I don't know if anybody can. So if you can't commit 1% of your day and then hopefully work off after that. And so 1% is better than 0%. I try to get people to commit to 15 minutes and then go from there. And then what I tell people is if you can't commit to 15 minutes a day and 1%, then you need 1 hour a day.
No, I agree with you. And the one thing I want to say is when Dr. Budding and I work together. She's a neuropsychologist. And, you know, usually I integrate the tools that you're talking about. I'm very fortunate. I have my practice set up where I discuss mindfulness. I really know my patients. It's sort of like an ideal way to practice psychiatry.
Awesome.
And so Dr. Budding and I get together with the very complex situations where people need all the feedback. And sometimes people need the numbers because if you qualitatively tell them, they might not hear it if they don't have a report.
Right.
And so she and I get together. So it'd be like you and I, like Dr. Steve and Dr. Denise sitting in a room with the family and sort of presenting, this is your child's neuro style and this is what we're recommending, with very, very concrete tools and realistic expectations based on that child and also based on that family system. So it sounds like that's what you're doing with your evaluations, and it's like you're on the trenches, like right at the front line, right? That's what you do. You're out there. Your day is like out there in the community, correct? Because it's a mobile psych service.
Well, four days. So mobile psych is kind of the main, you know, the PA, the professional association. And one day a week I do mobile, but I pretty much, I'm in two of my different offices, 2 days at one, 2 days at the other. I do a lot of stuff by phone, consultations. And then one day I go to other agencies. I used to do a lot of in-home stuff, but nowadays it's just gotten difficult to do that because my time is getting so strapped. So I pretty much only go to agencies or other organizations that may need like five or more people assessed. And so I basically go on site and assess a group of their people in their group home or their outpatient center and things like that. They kind of bring me out to, you know, to keep up with their demand of needing evaluations. And so mobile is pretty much by phone or consult. Because mm-hmm. I'm pretty much doing evaluations every hour on the hour, 5 or 6 days a week, and then I write reports, you know, starting at like 4 a.m. So I stay pretty busy, but I love it. It gives me time to have a flex schedule where I can do stuff with my kids. I have a really good group of people that working for me, other doctors or master level therapists. And then we do trainings with them to kind of carry out stuff to implement in ongoing therapy type processes.
That's awesome. So this is what's called the wraparound system. So you come up with a unique system and you make sure that there's follow through for the best outcome.
As best as you can. Unfortunately, there's just, even right now, I could probably have two more people working for me. It's just tough to find the right people that can really understand and want to do this type of work. You know, it's like I see so many people that they call themselves therapists with kids and they bring a kid in and they talk to him for an hour. You know, it's like the kid's six. It's like, you got to do stuff. You know,
I agree with you. I'm very solution oriented as well. You know, you've got to find a way to integrate what you discuss with someone in person into their lives. So I love that you provided the tools. And, you know, I really appreciate your site, you know, your program, the mental training program that's available online. Can you share with our listeners what they can expect from signing up for this program? And is it just for athletes?
No, so for athletes, for sure. There's a mental fitness section that kind of breaks it down, tennis, golf, MMA, mental fitness, that anybody, we call it the GP, the general population, you know, for whether you're just somebody interested in strengthening your mindset or somebody trying to get better, you know, performance enhancement wise for your type of work setting you're in. And we keep it pretty simple. I'm in the works right now of adding a component that specializes in just little kids. I have it right now on another program I use for my patients. It's called the Select Program, and it's free too, but I'm going to incorporate it all onto one site because it's finally, we've kind of got through the test phase of it, and it seems to be pretty doable. The hardest part is trying to figure out something that is efficient, meaning like you get something out of it. So it's good to do. It's a good use of your time, but that you can literally do independently without having to ask or call and need help to kind of get through. And when you get into the internet, that's really the art and science of it. You know, the science of it being good enough and worthy and evidence-based, so to speak. But the art of it being where you can kind of do it at home and figure it out on your own without needing the doctor with you at all times. I've told people, I say, you know, an hour of therapy is great, but you know what? There's 24 hours in a day and there's 7 days a week. Like, you need to be being able to do stuff on your own life independently and self-sufficiently. So I try to take anything good that comes out of my work and put it into a way that people can continue doing and add. That's the drills. I can help with you learn and know the skills, but you got to be able to do the drills a lot.
Yeah. Knowledge plus action, and then truly an integrative well-being. So people are thinking and in this mindset throughout their day and not thinking, oh, I'm about to go do this meeting, so I better be in that mindset. You know, you can really, life can be an absolute mindfulness and meditation all the time if you allow yourself to use these tools consistently.
I love that you say that because people have debated with me about that, but I said it's a 24-hour thing. I said,
I agree with you.
You sleep with your thoughts and how you sleep. You know, where you're sleeping, who you sleep with, what happens at night, whether it's dreams or nightmares or the type of bed you're on or floor you're on or whatever. I said, all this stuff plays into your well-being. And so it's 24 hours a day that you're impacting your consciousness and your mind and your well-being and your subconsciousness. And so I'm glad you are on the same page with that.
Well, actually, in between clients, talk about a ritual. I have a way of clearing things in my mind so that I'm only in the moment, like an athlete. You know, I played sports as well. I played goalie. And so I love that we can incorporate our experience as children playing sports into anything we do. And so I have rituals that I do to be on my A game, whether it's getting ready for this interview. I sort of had some thoughts and intentions and gratitude before I got on today. My father is not here on the earth plane, but I thought, oh my gosh, my dad's a big sports fan. This would be like his favorite podcast. So I was like thanking, like, yes, I get to talk to Dr. Steve. And then also kind of expressing gratitude throughout my day and my life. But then also in between clients, I have something that I do and like, that's like kind of a really sweet ritual. So it's like, I'm blessing the appointment and I'm asking myself to be present so I can really connect more soul to soul with them so that we can really do amazing work that doesn't only exist in the session, but transcends beyond the session.
I think that's the biggest. And, you know, I know you said these usually last an hour, so we're getting close to the end. But if I had to sum that up, I think one of the main things that I learn and try to help people understand with my work from the general population to the amateur athletes that want to be champion versus the elite is you can just tell so quick in a conversation with them. And if I had to pick the, well, what does that mean? You know, how they talk and how they think about things and how their mind works. You know, again, it goes back to those, the way they utilize things like meditation, rituals and routine, the self-control, and also, you know, what we call arousal regulation, the self-talk, and that falls into self-hypnosis, the cognitive thinking style they have. It doesn't have to be all positive. I got some athletes that are very successful. They're not positive thinkers, but they're not negative. That's the worst. They're neutral thinkers. You know, they're, you know, and that's a big difference. People don't understand that. Attention and concentration. Their ability to have vivid type of imagery and utilize those visualization drills, breath work, and goal setting. And if I had to pick just one, I think that separates the general population. You know, and I'm talking about the kids coming in that are needing help. You know, they're having problems at home, school, or and socially. And then the amateurs, they're having trouble kind of rising up to get in the top tier to go pro or be high level, you know, a top athlete in their field, is the goals. If I had to pick one word, it'd be almost, I would say, or two words, I'd compare being semi-delusional versus somebody reality-based. It just blows my mind, and it almost disturbs my mind at times. Day to day, the kids that I see, and when we get into kind of their neurostyle, and a lot of them, you know, we look at the weaknesses and where they're at cognitively, learning-wise, and they're so far behind. And, you know, between bad behavior and learning problems and other mental health issues they have. And when you really, you know, not to break a dream down, but what's realistically possible for them, you know, probably some good occupations and jobs, but, you know, but maybe not what they want to hear or know. My job is not to be the dream crusher by any means, but in my mind, I'm thinking about the reality of what their goals are. And when we get into their three wishes and their goals for career, it's just almost delusional. Everybody thinks they're going to play in the NBA, even though they don't have a basketball. They think they're going to be 50 Cent or Beyonce or one of these rappers. They can't sing. They never wrote a song, you know, or they don't do anything musical to even facilitate that dream. And so it's not even really a dream. It's like a fantasy to kind of escape from reality. And some of the amateurs that I've worked with too, I've worked with so many amateurs pro bono that tell me when we go over the goals, you know, I'm going to be UFC champ. And then we get into goal setting and really break down the goals, the short-term goal, you know, long-term goal, the short-term goal, then the super short-term goals, the stuff that takes day to day. They just don't have the discipline. They just really don't have the will or the drive or the ability to even do a lot of the stuff that it takes. And so again, it's yeah, that's the dream, but it's really semi-delusional and a fantasy because you're not willing to do the work that it takes to get it done. And some may not even have the skills. And that goes back to that skill and challenge ratio. I don't know if you ever, you know, knew like the work of Dr. Csikszentmihalyi with like flow. You know, and he was just the master of kind of bridging this balance in the zone, and optimal peak performance has to do with a balance between skill and challenge. And that's when you're in the flow state. And
I agree with you.
The problem with most people, you know, if I had to sum this up with the general population and athletes trying to get to the top, is you got to know your neural style and your capabilities, and then know what you need to work on, because most people either don't have the skills to meet the challenges of what they really want to do, or they may have the skills, but they don't ever push themselves and challenge themselves to get anywhere near they want to be. They're just out of whack. And so that's where I find, you know, being able to help people the most is got to sharpen the skills and face the challenges. And for some, we got to, you know, you got to enhance those skills and face the challenges, but it's really just a matter of those and whichever way you're looking at them.
I'm just pausing because if children at a very young age, it's integrated, what is my neurostyle? Who am I? And that sort of thinking happened in preschool and was integrated into society, then people would have realistic expectations to then use their understanding and self-awareness to then say, what are the skills I need to do based on my baseline style, whether it's my style of thinking or my style of movement with regard to sports? and what's realistic, and also have faith that the mind is amazing, that you can go sort of, there are infinite possibilities, but you have to have an awareness and a realistic day-to-day plan. So to me, society could be very well served if we had integrative psychological assessment for everyone, where people just knew their style, because then I think people could align sooner with their own gifts and their own goals, and that could make for the ripple effect for societal well-being.
I'm a big fan of that, and you know, and they do it in pro sports. You know, the NFL screens players out with these kind of brief psyche valves. They do it, you know, different occupations in a sense too, just to get a general understanding. Because if you know that about yourself, you can be someone that says, you know what, okay, this is my weakness. Okay, maybe I won't go in that career path I thought I was going to go, and I'm going to go this other way. Or you know what, that's a weakness. I really want to go in that direction, so I got to work extra hard if I want to go in that direction. You know, so it doesn't necessarily cast you into a certain category, but it lets you know what, okay, this is kind of what you're built for right now. But if you want to go this other direction, you're going to have to work really, really hard, you know. And so I love that. Mind is amazing. Nothing's impossible, but you got to be realistic. That's for sure.
Well, Dr. Steve, thank you so much for being on the show today. First of all, I'm excited that we've met, and I will take, if we wanted to do a quick call, I know you had some things we want to discuss, but I actually am just so excited to get to know you and the way you think, and all the work that you've been doing for the children, the teens, the adults, and the athletes. I just want to say thank you for your body of work, and thank you for being on the show today.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate it, and it's been a real blessing to get to know you and your work and what you're doing and out there in California. And the, you know, I'm sure business is good. I enjoy California. It's a wild place. It's the future. But in so many ways anyways, but it's been awesome. So thank you for having me, and thank you for having Gary on. That was a real pleasure for me.
Oh, good. That just came to me. That was just kind of being in the zone. I'm like, huh. I think I'd rather have Gary on this than than do a commercial. So thank you so much, Dr. Steve, and have a great rest of your day. Thanks a lot for everything.
You too. Have a great day.
This is Dr. Denise, and today we interview Dr. Stephen Hannant. You can follow him on Twitter at SportsStrength, SportsStrink, or visit his website, CallDrSteve.com, CallDrSteve.com. You can also inquire about his online mental training program at mentaltrainingprogram.com, MentalTrainingProgram.com. Thank you so much for listening.